On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Governor Evers signed a bill last month aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. It sets new requirements for pharmacy benefit managers and allows pharmacists to freely tell patients how to save money on their prescriptions. Evers at the signing ceremony at a health clinic in Wausau. This is courtesy of WDJT-TV.
It will save money and put more power in the hands of the pharmacists in the state of Wisconsin.
Where do you see ways to lower drug prices? Should there be more price transparency, more generics, something else? 800-642-1234. Two pharmacists who served on the governor's task force on prescription drug prices. Janet Fritsch is owner of Corner Drug Hometown Pharmacy in Baraboo. Janet, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We also have Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne, who's in charge of the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy in Madison. Yolanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, Yolanda, the task force, it met 8 times to talk about the causes of high drug prices and look for possible solutions. What did you take away from these meetings?
One of the things that I really appreciated was the governor assembled almost kind of like a team of rivals. So he had many different stakeholders in the pharmaceutical drug pricing world around the table to kind of develop solutions that were going to work for the majority. So I appreciated that.
You appreciated that also, did you find any common ground in surprising ways when you met with people in other parts of this industry?
Yes, I think we actually were able to achieve a lot. Sometimes the meetings got a little contentious, but I think overall we were united in agreement in the fact that, you know, drug prices remain too high and inaccessible for many.
Janet, what did you learn from this task force on prescription drug prices and serving on it?
I agree with Yolanda that it was beneficial to have lots of people from all of the different parts of the supply chain. So the manufacturers, the PBMs, the pharmacies, and other people. I also liked that they set us up with economists that had done research on the supply chain of prescription drugs. I thought that was very beneficial. It really resonated with me because it showed what my experience has been in terms of pricing and patients and how I get my drugs in my pharmacy. I also liked that they had patients that came in and talked to us, or when it was on Zoom that were on video. And I thought that really brought it down to what our goal was, what all of our goal is to reduce the price for the patient, either in what their copays are or in what our premiums are. And we are all there. We all have premiums. We all have prescriptions.
And when you said PBMs, those are pharmacy benefit managers, and we're going to look at that role in just a moment. But Yolanda, you know, state authorities estimate Wisconsin residents paid over $1.3 billion in 2019 for prescription drugs. What stories did you hear from people who came before the task force who have struggled to pay for medications?
We had a couple of families talk to us in particular about their struggles in paying for insulin in particular, which is a life-saving and necessary medication. They shared their compelling stories and their challenges, the challenges that they faced. We had one young man who was in his 20s, and his mother was in the healthcare industry, and in spite of that, they struggled mightily to make sure that he had care and was able to receive the insulin, and it changed his even life planning around his future because he was worried about not being able to afford this insulin that he needed to live, really.
insulin, such a huge issue. Janet, you know, what are you seeing there in terms of insulin affordability and what steps Wisconsin could take?
So in my store, I mean, diabetes is such a widespread condition, and diabetes, you don't just get one drug for that. You get a couple things, a couple different insulins. You might get other injectables, not to mention the oral drugs that you get. Plus, most diabetics also are getting blood pressure medication and cholesterol medication. So it's not just one, it's many. And a lot of people these days have high deductibles. Box of insulin, you know, that's $600. Well, we definitely see tons of people that get two or three boxes of insulin every month, in addition to all the other things. You're talking about thousands of dollars a month in just the prescriptions themselves. And I hear people talk about decreasing their insulin. I see that they don't fill it often enough. And I know that they're doing that because then it will decrease their price. I see people in my store that say, well, I can only take that box of insulin, not the other one, not this week. I'll try to get that one next week. Well, that means they're not using it. So that puts that person at risk. They may end up in the ER. They may have additional health concerns because of that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about ways to address prescription drug prices on the State Capitol Report. We have two pharmacists who served on a state task force on this issue. Janet Fritsch there from Corner Drug Hometown Pharmacy in Baraboo. Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne from St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy in Madison. And gathering your thoughts, how would you like to see the state address drug prices? Do you forego certain meds because you can't afford them? How has that affected your health? Join in at 800-642-1234. Yolanda, we heard from MG and DePeer, called in, couldn't stay with us, and wants to know more about generic drugs. And MG wonders, are they as effective as the brand name drugs? Why are they cost so much less, and where are they made?
There's a lot of good questions there. Generic drugs, oftentimes, are even made by the brand name manufacturers, but the generic drugs have the benefit of not having to pay for the research and development that went into the creation of the brand name original source drug. So they are able to basically gain access to the recipe and make their own. The generic companies are able to make their own versions of the medications that are out there, and they can do that at a considerably cheaper price. And that price can be passed on to the consumer.
And are they made where the brand name drug would be made? Or, you know, is there anything different in terms of where this drug these generics come from?
Well, the generic drug manufacturers are all over. Mm-hmm. Some are in the United States and some are outside of the country.
Janet,
but they do have to go through testing.
No, that's okay. You know, Janet, earlier you mentioned PBMs, the acronym for Pharmacy Benefit Managers. Governor Evers signed into law a bill that requires pricing disclosures from pharmacy benefit managers. How would this address drug prices?
So currently, PBMs are companies that work with insurance companies. So you pay your premium to an insurance company. The insurance company contracts out with a PBM who works with the prescription part of your insurance. And so they negotiate with manufacturers to bring down prices, and they also make contracts with pharmacies. So they work between those two entities. PBMs pretty much set the prices for things between them and the manufacturers. So, but no, there's not much transparency in that entire process. So if we could have more transparency, then the idea is that we would know more about what's going on, and that would bring down prices.
There's also something that didn't get a green light, which is in regulating pharmacy benefit managers, is something called patient steerage or prescription drug steerage. Yolanda, can you tell us more about what is patient steerage?
I I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay.
As it's defined.
Yeah, I mean, this practice with PBMs, are you familiar, Janet, with, encouraging patients to buy meds at stores owned by PBMs for lower prices?
So PBMs usually have their own pharmacy. There's three major PBMs in the United States that have 80% of the business, and they also are connected with their own pharmacies. So they can set preferred networks where patients get a better price if they go to that pharmacy. It means that other pharmacies like my own can't always serve the patients that they've been serving depending on what insurance company they have. And sometimes my pharmacy is not able to get into that preferred network. So it does steer patients to those pharmacies or their mail order pharmacies and will not allow patients to come to a store such as mine.
How does that impact you and your operations?
Well, it definitely affects me in terms of business and how much business I get. But more importantly, it means that patients don't have the choice of where they can get their prescriptions. So they have to go to certain places, which might not be a good fit for them. There are certainly a lot of people, vulnerable populations, that mail order just is not a good option. I get questions every single week about what prescriptions people got from their mail order, what they look like, what the directions are, that they didn't come in the mail and now they don't know what to do, or they don't know how to take it, or I think people probably don't ask the question and then they really don't know. It really keeps them from having a personal relationship with their pharmacist, which for many of these vulnerable people, that's really important.
We have pharmacist Janet Fritsch, who owns a local pharmacy in Baraboo. Pharmacist Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne runs a charitable pharmacy in Madison. What questions do you have about how the drug supply chain works? What should lawmakers do to regulate the industry? Pharmacists and physicians, what advice do you have for the state to reduce consumer prices? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about prescription drug costs on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The governor's task force on reducing prescription drug prices, it met 8 times to discuss potential policy options from November 2019 through last summer. Then in October, they presented their findings and recommendations in a report that was over 150 pages. How do you want the state to address drug prices? Do you forego certain meds or cut pills in half because you can't afford them? It's 800-642-1234. We have pharmacists Janet Fritsch of Baraboo and Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne of Madison. They were on the task force. They're with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Gary now in Iron River. Hi, Gary. What has your experience been like?
Well, good morning. Some years ago, I was prescribed a generic drug that was on a long list of drugs that Walmart would sell for $10 a prescription. That was less than my insurance copay, so I was just going to pay for it. When I went to try and buy it from Walmart, I was told that Wisconsin had a law that prevented them from selling that one or some of those drugs on that list for that price because it was below market price. And I understand that's probably an issue between prices they want to charge and what independent pharmacies have to charge. But it increased the cost for me to get the drug, that's for sure.
Yeah, Gary, what did you ultimately do?
I bought it through the insurance company and paid the $17 copay for a drug I could have bought for $10 at Walmart.
Janet, what are your thoughts here?
So there have been regulations by PBMs or regulations that PBMs would not allow pharmacists to tell patients when there was a cheaper alternative. So if either there was a drug that was similar and it was cheaper, or if it was just cheaper than paying their insurance copay, we actually weren't allowed to tell patients that. We would get calls from the insurance companies telling us they would cancel our contract if we did that. This law actually stops that. So there is no longer a gag clause. So we now are able to tell our patients what is the cheaper alternative for them. In Gary's case, I don't exactly know why they weren't able to sell it for the $10, but now there is no gag clause because of this law.
Yolanda, are gag orders ever an issue in your work?
No, they're not, actually, because we're dealing with the folks that don't have insurance at all. And so we serve as we're considered the safety net. So we're able to take care of the folks that don't have the insurance. So in some ways, it's simpler. The problem for us is that a lot of folks don't know about us, that we exist and that we're here to help as well. So we're not competing against pharmacies like the independent pharmacy that Janet runs, nor the big box, Walgreens and chain pharmacies. We're actually trying to take care of the folks that they can't. So it's really about us all working together to kind of work on managing this very huge and important issue.
Yolanda, a majority of the task force supported increasing funds for free and charitable clinics like yours. Could that have an impact beyond the consumers who receive their medications from these clinics?
I do believe so. There are over 100 free and charitable clinics throughout the state. And again, I think a lot of people don't know that we exist. And our purpose is really to kind of work alongside the patients to really help provide folks the care that they need in tandem with other providers throughout the community. So I think that there's a role for us that is kind of not fully realized.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about ideas to address prescription drug prices on the State Capitol Report. We have two pharmacists who served on a task force on this issue, Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne of Madison, Janet Fritch of Baraboo, and your thoughts on prescription drug prices and how you go about getting your prescriptions filled. 800-642-1234. Janet, the task force supported creating a government-run entity to allow greater leverage in drug purchasing power. And this entity would initially serve government purchasers. How would this work?
So there are other states that have used this and have been somewhat successful in it. I don't think that it's been used very long. So there wasn't a ton of evidence as to how much it would reduce the prices. But the idea is that because the state is a large buyer of mm-hmm. prescription drugs for state employees and other state-run agencies, that then because of that large purchasing power, they would be able to lower prescription prices.
Okay, so having a much larger pool of people in there would give them leverage in purchasing. Josh is joining us from Sturtevant. Josh, hi. What is your question?
Well, I'm definitely for some kind of reform when it comes to pricing. I actually have to take Eliquist because for some reason I get blood clots. And in fact, I get them even on Eliquist, which is what I guess the point of what I'm about to say. Eliquis without insurance is like $400 a bottle, and they have this coupon program that you're supposed to be on, and if you miss renewing that, which I just did because I wasn't home when the mail came through for the time period to get it like done, I now am trying to figure out how to take what I have left. I'm supposed to take two a day. I'm taking one a day, and I'm not taking them on Saturday and Sundays even, because I have to somehow, according to this coupon thing, stretch that for the next 6 months unless I want to be paying $400 a bottle. And in comparison with the coupon, it's $10 a bottle.
Wow.
So I'm all for something changing when it comes to how this works.
Yolanda, can you weigh in there on Josh's situation?
Sure. All of the drug companies do have not only for they have an indigent patient assistance program. You can go on a website called needymeds.org, and they have many programs actually specific to the drug that provide assistance for folks. And some of them are geared towards folks that don't have insurance, but there are other programs that do help folks that are like, for example, in the donut hole, or they have also become more generous in terms of the income requirements to provide access to those medications. You can also go directly to the manufacturers, and they have coupon cards too. Another thing, asking providers for samples, if they do have samples of some of the medications, that's also another option that you can explore. But I would recommend going into needymeds.org. There are several programs, oftentimes, for many of the drugs that are out there. So
yeah,
if you need help, I can help with that offline.
Well, Janet and Yolanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Pharmacists Janet Fritsch and Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne, they served on the Governor's Task Force on Prescription Drug Prices. They are from Corner Drug Hometown Pharmacy in Baraboo and St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy in Madison, respectively. And for disclosure, St. Vincent de Paul of Madison is a business sponsor of WPR. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with State Senator Van Wongaard. News update is next on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State houses across the country have proposed hundreds of bills this year targeting police oversight and use of force. That's according to a tracking database maintained by the National Conference of State Legislatures. What direction will Wisconsin go on policing laws? What changes would you like to see made in how police officers use force? Do you think we need to rethink how police do their jobs? Where do we start? 800-642-1234. Van Wongaard is a Republican state senator and majority caucus chair from the 21st District, which includes parts of Racine and Kenosha counties. Senator Wongaard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Let's start with last week's conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. What is your reaction to the verdict?
Well, you know, I didn't follow the entire trial, but I did look at what some of the factual information that was coming out, and obviously picture that you got with an officer in the street, you know, having his knee around the neck of the individual was obviously something that is not trained, at least here in Wisconsin. That's not something that is trained here, especially for, you know, that length of time. If it's something where you're getting a person under control and you're fighting for your life, that might be a different situation, at least until you get them under control. But that went on and on, so that was not acceptable. As far as the conviction, the only thing I didn't understand is being found guilty of all three charges that I thought they all pretty much sounded like they included the same elements from each offense. So I don't know how you can be convicted of all three. But that's Minnesota law, and I'm not sure how that actually works out. Here you would be found guilty of the highest charge that's being brought forward, and I mean, if there's some smaller charges, those would normally be read in. So I'm not really sure how that works out, but you've got a jury that is working on this, and the only difficulty I see with that is there was so much outside pressure on this jury. I'm not sure that all of the information that was brought forward was actually absorbed by the jury because of the outside pressure to them and their families, and the feeling of intimidation, according to some of the alternate jurors that have stepped out, that really creates a problem with our system of law. So you hope there's going to be a good, clean, clear process that everybody can look at, and if something went wrong, then there needs to be a consequence. So we'll see how this works out with the courts now.
Well, let's look at Wisconsin now. You're co-sponsoring a number of bills related to policing. Why are reforms needed in the way that police departments do their work here in Wisconsin?
Well, some of the bills that we're working on, just so everybody's clear, didn't just pop up in the last couple weeks or months, and in several cases, years. We have been working on some of these bills that are being brought forward for as much as 4 or 5 years. And one of those is the oversight bill, the law enforcement use of force oversight board that would go in, and it would act just like the National National Transportation Safety Board that comes in and reviews crashes that occur with common carriers like buses or airplanes and things like that. We want to make sure that we have confidence instilled in that process of transportation. So that board comes in and looks at all of the processes that led to the event that you have a challenge with. So if a plane falls out of the sky, you want to know why and how that happens so that you can prevent potentially that happening again. That's the basis for our law enforcement use of force board, is to go in and assess all of the circumstances that occurred in the continuum that led up to whatever the event was that was a negative event where there was either a death or serious injury occurring with an officer interaction. So if you can look at the process and you can have somebody who is not connected to the process, because this would not be as a judgmental group, it would be totally separate and autonomy, and have its own autonomy from anything that would be looking at the criminal aspect for a potential violation of law or the civil aspect for a violation of policy, procedure, those types of things. Those investigations would still go on. This group would have the ability to bring in experts and look at exactly how things happened and see if, you know, maybe there needs to be some changes in how we do things. Law enforcement has changed. I started in 1972, and law enforcement has continued to change, and oftentimes law enforcement is one of the last to have the benefits of technology, as an example. I mean, we have people back in my day, when I first started, we had call boxes. That's the only way we could communicate because we didn't have enough handheld radios. And as that's changed, every officer now takes their own radio home. We have better communications all the way along the line. And a lot of times the private sector advances first. You know, everybody has a cell phone, but then not everybody has a radio. So, I mean, as these things change, we need to change with them. And that's the idea behind the legislation that we've been working on and have brought to fruition over the last several months.
Well, you talk about the evolution of technology. A lot of the legislation you're proposing is mirroring some recommendations from the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities. And one of the recommendations from the task force is that all patrol officers be equipped with body cameras. Is that something you'd support?
Absolutely. You know, this has been something that's been ongoing, too, is getting our departments to be able to have those resources. And I will tell you, when all of a sudden you have, if you're a mid-sized department and you've got 50, 60, 70 officers, that's a pretty expensive outlay of just hardware, you know, for each one of those cameras that those individuals are going to have to wear. So it's not so much just that hardware, even though that's a lot of money that they're going to spend for those. A lot of small communities don't have that. So this is an area where state and federal dollars can come into play to help those departments become more more up-to-date with, you know, some of the things that are available. A photo's worth a thousand words, I think, is what the phrase is. But you also have to remember that when an officer's out there, or anybody's out there, and we've seen this on camera footage that has been taken in the past, it's the perspective that you're only getting one level of perspective here. It's from the camera. So depending on where that camera's aimed and how it's worn, specific to the situation you're dealing with, you may not get everything that is going to be available. That's why when we look at processes where there's been officer-involved issues and other people are around, you know, everybody has a cell phone with a camera on it, and they start filming. So when that happens, you know, we get all different types of perspectives, and that's why it's so important to look at and let the investigative process work out. When the investigators work on that, when we have something there where we have a loss of life or something where somebody is really hurt seriously in an officer-involved situation, you want to make sure you get the whole thing and that you're able to review each one of those things so you get the actual real-time perspective of the officer that is, remember, responding to something, a call for service that somebody is in dire need of assistance to help solve that problem. And officers have been put in that position where they're kind of, everybody has the expectation they're just going to come and they're going to make everything good and it's going to be fixed just like that because they know how to do everything. And you got to remember, police officers are like anybody else. They can make mistakes. But cameras, will help help those officers be better officers. It will help those officers explaining and articulating why they did what they did. And remember, these officers are responding to situations in tenths of seconds, you know, and when seconds count, officers are minutes away.
So what I'm hearing from you is you support widespread use of body cameras throughout departments across the state. That is if the small departments that have less funding can afford the body cameras?
Well, I think every department should have that resource available to their officers. I think it supports their goal of good policing. And like I said, having the dollars to be able to do that, you know, sometimes that's a little challenging, but most departments are working on that, getting that. And I think there's been more of a push now today with working to provide some of those resources, both through the state and federal governments, to help departments through grant programs to obtain that that type of hardware. The biggest expense I think that's out there for a lot of departments is once they've developed their policy for use of those cameras is the storage issue. With storing it, how long, you know, what's going to be available. And quite honestly, the individuals that are not involved in whatever the call for service was, they have privacy rights too. So, you know, it's sorting out all that, how you store it, how do you take and redact somebody from a video cam footage. And there's ways of doing that where they can go in and blur the face and stuff like that. But that all takes a little bit of time in the process. And I think that once we kind of figure that out, I think it's going to be so commonplace. I remember when I was on the department and they came up with squad car cameras where they were in the squads. And some people pushed back and said, well, I don't know if this is a good idea. You know, this is going to be used to hurt the officers and to catch them when they're not wearing their tie or something simple like that for violations of policies. But in the long run, I think it's been a proven positive when we've had officers that have approached situations with vehicular stops, like the officer in, I think it was Arizona, that got out to do a traffic stop, and where they were talking about officers should do traffic stops and leave their firearm in the car. And when this guy got out of his car to approach the car on the passenger side of the car, you know, he did the approaches, everything was correct, and the perpetrator got out from the driver's side, pulled out a long gun, and shot the officer and killed him. And so there's training things we can use those types of things for, too. But, you know, you get the good things and the bad things that happen with it. So we just have to be able to sort out how we utilize that. How do we use that to make our approach to solving problems better?
We're talking with Van Wongard, who's a Republican state senator who represents parts of Racine and Kenosha counties, as we look at what's on the table for proposed changes to state laws on policing. Connor is joining us in Madison. Hi, Connor. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is Connor. I just have a few thoughts. First thought is Arizona is in Wisconsin. And, you know, we're talking about a neighboring state here in Minnesota where body camera footage was not what led to that officer's conviction. Now, in our own state, the Department of Justice is basically handcuffed when you have acts of police brutality. The police are supposed to investigate themselves somehow, and that's just ridiculous because I've experienced things you would not even believe or imagine could possibly be true, but I've been sexually assaulted by police, and I can't get them to investigate themselves. So I want to know what kind of solutions you actually have for people like me coming through in the legislature, because I don't see any help coming from that department.
Representative Wongard, go ahead.
Okay, so there was a lot of questions there. Let me just try to put out the first one. Yes, I understand that Wisconsin is not the other states, and that's actually a good thing. Wisconsin is the tip of the spear and leader in a lot of reforms, whether it be law enforcement or it be in agriculture or tourism. We're a leader in all those different areas, economic development, workforce. All those things are positives that we are different. We take different approaches to trying to be problem solvers here. With your issue and anybody's issue, when we have departments that do go out and have somebody that we believe gets involved in a situation where somebody is hurt or there's a accusation or claim against an officer, that officer has to be treated as an individual that is innocent until proven guilty also. And that's why we go through the process of putting people, if there is a complaint, and you have a complaint against a specific officer, we're going to ask you to put that complaint in writing and under penalty of a violation of of false swearing. So if you're telling the truth, not a problem, and it will be investigated. And it's not always the same department that does those types of investigations. Those investigations are handed over to other jurisdictions that would come in and do that investigation. And if it's something where it's a sexual assault or something such as that, that would be handled most likely by the Department of Justice, or it could also be handled by the federal government, who would come in and they would look at the circumstances pertaining to whatever that alleged incident was, and they would work to resolve that and get to the bottom of what happened. So it's not about its own police department doing its own investigation to determine if the officers did wrong. Yes, those individual departments, if they're a big enough department, will probably have an internal affairs unit that will look at all of the circumstances and determine if there is a violation of policy, procedure. And if there's a criminal violation, that would also support the investigation that's being done by alternate jurisdictions. And ultimately, they would bring forth whatever findings were there. And if there's a violation of policy and procedure, it should be dealt with by that department with a suspension, a demotion, or any other disciplinary thing up to termination. And it would be put forth to their police and fire commission or public service commission. If they're a county employee, it goes to public service. If they're a local police department they're big enough, they'd have a police and fire commission. They would determine that discipline. And if there's a criminal act that's occurred with it, that would be referred to either their district attorney or potentially an adjacent county district attorney if there would be issues with potential conflicts, because we don't want there to be conflicts. We want it to be a good, clean, clear, crisp, transparent process.
All right. State Senator Van Wongard of Racine stays with us as we discuss police oversight, accountability, use of force. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Republican State Senator Van Wongard of Racine. He chairs the 7-member Senate Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. We're discussing proposals on the use of force, the oversight of police officers, possible penalties for protesters. And Senator Wongard is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's look more closely at no-knock warrants. Your colleague, Senator Lena Taylor, has co-sponsored several of your bills, and she has a bill you're not sponsoring, which would prohibit no-knock warrants and require all search warrants be executed between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. What are your thoughts on that proposal?
That is ludicrous. To take and take away a tool that law enforcement has to protect themselves, the people that they are serving that warrant on, and anybody else that would be surrounding that potential service of the warrant is absolutely nuts. First of all, you have to understand our system of even getting a search warrant from a judge. It's not you just walk in and say, hey, I want to search this house, and they give you a warrant in 2 minutes. That doesn't happen. You have to have a warrant that describes the property, that has background on the people involved, and there's what they call an affidavit to support the warrant. That's where all the particulars are, where in most cases here, at least down in Racine and Kenosha counties, if we have something where they're going to serve a warrant, they would have to have intelligence on the location that they're serving that warrant. Say, if we're doing a drug manufacturing house that they're going after, they would have somebody that would have firsthand knowledge of what is present in that house that's a violation of the law that rises to the level to get a search warrant to begin with. And that individual or individuals would have knowledge specific to defensive things that are in place inside of that that focus of the search warrant. So if they have guns or they have battery acid like they do, or they have vicious dogs chained in the entryway to where somebody's going to be coming in, these are all things that would support going and asking the judge not for just the search warrant, but a no-knock warrant. So that means that they'd be able to enter without telling somebody that they're on the way, so they can grab their guns, let their dogs loose, and get the battery acid ready. And these are things that happen on a daily basis. And I think it's important to understand that when a judge signs off on a warrant, let alone a no-knock warrant, they are very, very particular here in Wisconsin. Other states, I don't know what their process is, but I know that here, and I've talked to my judges here. I also have a seat on the Judicial Council, talk with judges from the Supreme Court on down to local judges. This is not something that they take lightly. And so eliminating is nuts. Then to have a window, come on, we're only going to serve them from 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. at night. So at 10:01, the bad guys are going to start doing everything they need to do with their human trafficking or their manufacture of illegal drugs, et cetera, because the police can't do a warrant anyway. This is nuts. You know, so I think that the people that have looked at this don't have any idea or any concept of what it is to actually have a warrant and serve the warrant, what the purpose of a warrant is, let alone a no-knock.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing here is that you see no compromise or
yeah,
no...
not going anywhere. No.
Okay.
And I've had discussions with the Attorney General that agrees that no-knock warrants have a place in what we're doing in law enforcement. And like I said, in Wisconsin here, you can hear all these things from all these different places and how they do their warrants. That's like the one caller said, this Wisconsin is not those states. We are way ahead of other states with looking for accountability and training. And, I mean, we do everything really better. Can we make it even better? Can we improve it? Absolutely. There's always potential for improvement.
State Senator Van Wongard, very quickly here, the proposed George Floyd Justice and Policing Act getting traction in Congress, it would do a number of things, including changing the standards for how the use of force is evaluated. Do you support this law?
I have not seen the law, so it's difficult for me to say what I would support and not support. But I do want to remind people that this individual, George Floyd, lives only blocks from where my son lives in Minneapolis. This individual was a criminal. This individual was being taken into custody, fought officers for about 19 minutes before the situation occurred. Were officers right with how they held him down? Absolutely not. But you got to remember that they fought this guy for about 19 minutes as the process led on, and he obstructed them. And I will tell you that an individual that's high on fentanyl or on meth, they are 10 times stronger than you can imagine. I've fought with individuals like that, and I nearly lost my career when I first started and was a jailer and had to deal with somebody like that in the jail. This person was just like he was Superman. And so you have to take that into account and perspective. It can't be that, you know, they're going to take the one thing and they're going to all of a sudden make this individual into a saint. You got to remember, if this individual would have complied in the beginning, there wouldn't have been a problem to begin with. And
okay,
you need to look at the root causes. The drug addictions and those things, I think, are something where it's distracting our focus from the root causes that we really need to get to and we really need to work to problem solve.
State Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate. Have a great day.
Van Wongard, Republican State Senator, Majority Caucus Chair. This is the State Capitol Report on the Ideas Network.